through the 12 o'clock news. I miss my stories because the ladies is in the dining room having a benefit meeting, and I ain't allowed to turn on the TV when they's company. And that's fine. My muscles is shivering, they so tired. But I don't want to stop moving. About 4 o'clock, Miss Skeeter come in the kitchen. Before she can even say hello, Miss Leafo rush in behind her. Aveline, I just found out Mrs. Fredericks is driving down from Greenwood tomorrow and staying through Thanksgiving. I want the silver service polished and all the guest towels washed. Tomorrow I'll give you a list of what else. Miss Leafo shake her head at Miss Skeeter like, ain't she got the hardest life in town, and walks out. I go on and get the silver service out the dining room. Law, I'm already tired and got to be ready to work the benefit next Saturday night. Minnie ain't coming. She too scared she gonna run into Miss Hilly. Miss Skeeter still waiting on me in the kitchen when I come back in. She got a Miss Myrna letter in her hand. You got a cleaning question, I sigh. Go ahead. Not really. I wanted to ask you the other day. I take a plug of pinola cream and start rubbing it onto the silver, working the cloth around the rose design, the lip, and the handle. God, please let tomorrow come soon. I ain't gonna go to the gravesite, I can't. It'll be too hard. Aveline, are you feeling all right? I stop, look up, realize Miss Skeeter been talking to me the whole time. I'm sorry. I just thinking about something. You look so sad. Miss Skeeter, I feel tears come up in my eyes, 'cause 3 years just ain't long enough. 100 years ain't gonna be long enough. You mind if I help you with them questions tomorrow? Miss Skeeter start to say something, but then she stopped herself. Of course. I hope you feel better. I finish the silver set and the towels and tell Miss Leafold I got to go home, even though it's half an hour early and she gonna short my pay. She opened her mouth like she wanna protest, and I whisper my lie. I vomited. And she say, go. 'Cause besides her own mother, there ain't nothing Miss Leafold's scared of more than Negro diseases. All right, then. I'll be back in 30 minutes. I'll pull right up here at 9:45. Miss Leafold say through the passenger car window. Miss Leafold dropping me off at the Jitney 14 to pick up what else we need for Thanksgiving tomorrow. You bring her back that receipt now, Miss Fredericks, Miss Leafold's mean old mama say. They all three in the front seat, May Mobley squeezed in the middle with a look so miserable you think she about to get a tetanus shot. Poor girl. Miss Frederick's supposed to stay 2 weeks this time. Don't forget the turkey now, Miss Leafold say, and 2 cans of cranberry sauce. I smile. I only been cooking white Thanksgiving since Calvin Coolidge was president. Quit squirming, May Mobley, Miss Frederick snapped, or I'll pinch you. Miss Leafold, let me take her in the store with me. Help me with my shopping. Miss Frederick's about to protest, but Miss Leafold say, take her. And before I know it, baby girl done wormed her way over Miss Frederick's lap and is climbing out the window in my arms like I am the Lord Savior. I pull her up on my hip and they drive off toward Fortification Street. And baby girl and me, we giggle like a couple of schoolgirls. I push open the metal door, get a cart, and put May Mobley up front, stick her legs through the holes. Long as I got my white uniform on, I'm allowed to shop in this jitney. I miss the old days when you just walk out to Fortification Street and there'd be farmers with their wheelbarrows calling out, sweet potatoes, butter beans, string beans, okra, fresh cream, buttermilk, yellow cheese, eggs. But the jitney ain't so bad. At least they got the good air condition. All right, baby girl, let's see what we need. In produce, I pick out 6 sweet potatoes, 3 handfuls of string beans. I get a smoked ham hock from the butcher. The store is bright, lined up neat. Nothing like the colored Piggly Wiggly with sawdust on the floor. It's mostly white ladies smiling, got their hair already fixed and sprayed for tomorrow. 4 or 5 maids is shopping, all in their uniforms.
"Purple stuff,"
May Mobley say, and I let her hold the can of cranberry. She smile at it like it's an old friend. She loved the purple stuff. In dry goods, I heave the 2-pound bag of salt in the cart to brine the turkey in. I count the hours on my hands, 10, 11, 12. If I'm gonna soak the bird for 14 hours in the salt water, I'll put it in the bucket around 3 this afternoon. Then I'll come into Miss Leafolt's at 5 tomorrow morning and cook the turkey for the next 6 hours. I already baked 2 pans of cornbread, left it to stale on the counter today to give it some crunch. I got an apple pie ready to bake, gonna do my biscuits in the morning. "Ready for tomorrow, Abilene?" I turn and see Fanny Coots behind me. She go to my church, work for Miss Caroline on manship. "Hey, cutie, look at them fat legs," she say to May Mobley. May Mobley licked the cranberry can. Franny bend her head down, say, "You hear what happened to Luvenia Brown's grandson this morning?" "Robert?" I say, "who do the mowing?" "Use the white bathroom at Pinchman Lawn and Garden. Say there wasn't a sign up saying so. 2 white men's chased him and beat him with a tire iron." "Oh, no. Not Robert. He... is he?" Franny shake her head. "They don't know. He up at the hospital. I heard he blind. God, no." I close my eyes. Luvenia. She is the purest, kindest person there is. She raised Robert after her own daughter died. Poor Luvenia. I don't know why the bad have to happen to the goodest ones, Franny say. That afternoon, I worked like a crazy woman, chopping onions and celery, mixing up my dressing, rice and sweet potatoes, stringing the beans, polishing silver. I heard folks is heading to Luvenia Brown's tonight at 5:30 to pray for Robert. But by the time I lift that 20-pound turkey in the brine, I can't barely raise my arms. I don't finish cooking till 6 o'clock that night, 2 hours later than usual. I know I ain't gonna have the strength to go knock on Luvenia's door. I'll have to do it tomorrow, after I'm done cleaning up the turkey. I waddle myself from the bus stop, hardly able to keep my eyes open. I turn the corner on Jessam. A big white Cadillac's parked in front of my house. And there be Miss Skeeter in a red dress and red shoes, setting on my front steps like a bullhorn. I walk real slow through my yard, wondering what it's gonna be now. Mosquito stand up holding her pocketbook tight like it might get snatched. White peoples don't come around my neighborhood lest they totin' the help to and fro, and that is just fine with me. I spend all day long tending to white peoples. I don't need 'em looking in on me at home. "I hope you don't mind me coming by," she say. I didn't know where else we could talk." I sat down on the step and every knob on my spine hurt. Baby girl so nervous around her grandmama, she wet all over me, and I smell like it. The street's full of folks walking to Sweet Luvenia's to pray for Robert. Kids playing ball in the street. Everybody looking over at us thinking I must be getting fired or something. "Yes, ma'am," I sigh. "What can I do for you?"
"I have an idea, something I want to write about, but I need your help."
I let all my breath out. "I like Miss Skeeter, but come on. Sure, a phone call would have been nice. She never would have just shown up on some white lady's step without calling. But no, she done plopped herself down like she got every right to barge in on me at home.
I want to interview you about what it's like to work as a maid.
A red ball rolled a few feet in my yard. The little Jones boy run across the street to get it. When he see Miss Skeeter, he stopped dead. Then he run and snatch it up. He turn and dash off like he scared she gonna get him. Like the Miss Myrna column, I say, flat as a pan, about cleaning.
Not like Miss Myrna, I'm talking about a book, she say, and her eyes is big, she excited. Stories about what it's like to work for a white family, what it's like to work for, say, Elizabeth.
I turn and look at her.
Just what she's been trying to ask me the past 2 weeks in Miss Leafolk kitchen. You think Miss Leafolk gonna agree to that? Me telling stories about her?
Miss Skeeter's eyes dropped down some.
Well, no, I was thinking we wouldn't tell her. I'll have to make sure the other maids will agree to keep it secret, too.
I scrunch up my forehead, just starting to get what she's asking.
Other maids? I was hoping to get 4 or 5, to really show what it's like to be a maid in Jackson.
I look around. We out here in the wide open. Don't you know how dangerous this could be? Talking about this while the whole world can see us?
Exactly what kind of stories you think you gonna hear?
What you get paid, how they treat you, the bathrooms, the babies, all the things you've seen, good and bad.
She looks excited like this is some kind of game. For a second, I think I might be more mad than I am tired.
Miss Skeeter, I whisper, do that not sound kind of dangerous to you?
Not if we're careful.
Shh, please. Do you know what would happen to me if Miss Leafolk find out I talked behind her back?
We won't tell her, or anyone.
She lowers her voice some, but not enough. These will be private interviews.
I just stare at her. Is she crazy? Did you hear about the color boy this morning? The one they beat with a tire iron for accidentally using the white bathroom?
She just look at me, blink a little.
I know things are unstable, but this is... And my cousin Chanel in Calder County, they burn up her car 'cause she went down to the voting station.
No one's ever written a book like this, she say, finally whispering, finally starting to understand, I guess.
We'd be breaking new ground. It's a brand new perspective.
I spot a flock of maids in their uniforms walking by my house. They look over, seeing me with a white woman on my front step. I grit my teeth. I already know my phone gonna be ringing tonight.
Miss Skeeter. And I say it slow, trying to make it count.
I do this with you. I might as well burn my own house down.
Miss Skeeter start biting her nail then. But I've already...
She shut her eyes closed tight. I think about asking her, already what? But I'm kind of scared to hear what she gonna say.
She reach in her pocketbook, pull out a scrap of paper, and write her telephone number on it.
Please, will you at least think about it?
I sigh, stare out at the yard. Gentle as I can, I say, no, ma'am. She set the scrap of paper between us on the step. Then she get in her Cadillac. I'm too tired to get up. I just stay there. Watch while she roll real slow down the road. The boys playing ball clear the street, stand on the side, frozen. Like it's a funeral car passing by.
Miss Skeeter, Chapter 8. I drive down Jessam Avenue in Mama's Cadillac. Up ahead, a little colored boy in overalls watches me, wide-eyed, gripping a red ball. I look into my rear-view mirror. Abilene is still on her front steps in her white uniform. She hadn't even looked at me when she said, "No, ma'am." She just kept her eyes set on that yellow patch of grass in her yard. I guess I thought it would be like visiting Constantine, where friendly colored people waved and smiled, happy to see the little white girl whose daddy owned the big farm. But here, narrow eyes watch me pass by. When my car gets close to him, the little colored boy turns and scats behind a house a few down from Abilene's. Half a dozen colored people are gathered in the front yard of the house, holding trays and bags. I rub my temples. I try to think of something more that might convince Abilene. A week ago, Pascagoula knocked on my bedroom door.
"There's a long-distance phone call for you, Miss Skeeter, from a Miss Stern," she say.
"Stern?" I thought out loud. Then I straightened. "Do you mean Stein?"
I reckon it could have been Stein. She talked kind of hard sounding.
I rushed past Pascagoula, down the stairs. For some stupid reason, I kept smoothing my frizzy hair down as if it were a meeting and not a phone call. In the kitchen, I grabbed the phone dangling against the wall. 3 weeks earlier, I'd typed out the letter on Strathmore white. 3 pages outlining the idea, the details, and the lie, which was that a hard-working and respected colored maid has agreed to let me interview her and describe in specifics what it's like to work for the white women of our town. Weighing it against the alternative, that I planned to ask a colored woman for help, saying she'd already agreed to it seemed infinitely more attractive. I stretched the cord into the pantry, pulled the string on the single bare bulb. The pantry is shelved, floor to ceiling, with pickles and soup jars, molasses, put-up vegetables, and preserves. This was my old high school trick to get some privacy.
"Hello? This is Eugenia speaking."
"Please hold. I'll put the call through."
I heard a series of clicks and then a far, far away voice, almost as deep as a man's, say,
"Elaine Stein."
"Hello? This is Eugenia Phelan in Mississippi?"
"I know, Miss Phelan. I called you."
I heard a match strike, a short, sharp inhale.
"I received your letter last week. I have some comments."
"Yes, ma'am."
I sank down onto a tall tin can of King Biscuit flour. My heart thumped as I strained to hear her. A phone call from New York. Truly sounded as crackly as 1,000 miles away ought to.
"What gave you this idea about interviewing domestic housekeepers? I'm curious."
I sat paralyzed a second. She offered no chatting or hello, no introduction of herself. I realized it was best to answer her as instructed.
I was raised by a colored woman. I've seen how simple it can be, and how complex it can be between the families and the help." I cleared my throat. I sounded stiff, like I was talking to a teacher.
"Continue."
"Well," I took a deep breath, "I'd like to write this showing the point of view of the help, the colored women down here."
I tried to picture Constantine's face, Abilene's.
"They raise a white child, and then 20 years later the child becomes the employer. It's that irony, that we love them, and they love us, yet..."
I swallowed, my voice trembling.
"We don't even allow them to use the toilet in the house."
Again, there was silence.
"And..." I felt compelled to continue. "Everyone knows how we white people feel. The glorified mammy figure who dedicates her whole life to a white family. Margaret Mitchell covered that. But no one ever asked Mammy how she felt about it."
Sweat dripped down my chest, blotting the front of my cotton blouse.
"So, you want to show a side that's never been examined before?"
Mrs. Stein said.
"Yes, because no one ever talks about it. No one talks about anything down here."
Elaine Stein laughed like a growl. Her accent was tight, Yankee.
Miss Phelan, I lived in Atlanta for 6 years with my first husband.
I latched on to this small connection.
So you know what it's like, then? Enough to get me out of there,
she said, and I heard her exhale her smoke.
Look, I read your outline. It's certainly original, but it won't work. What maid in her right mind would ever tell you the truth?
I could see Mother's pink slippers pass by the door. I tried to ignore them. I couldn't believe Mrs. Stein was already calling my bluff. The first interviewee is eager to tell her story.
Miss Phelan,
Elaine Stein said, and I knew it wasn't a question.
This Negro actually agreed to talk to you candidly about working for a white family? Because that seems like a hell of a risk in a place like Jackson, Mississippi.
I sat blinking. I felt the first fingers of worry that Abilene might not be as easy to convince as I'd thought. Little did I know what she would say to me on her front steps the next week.
I watched them try to integrate your bus station on the news,
Mrs. Stein continued.
They jammed 55 Negroes in a jail cell built for 4.
I pursed my lips. She has agreed. Yes, she has.
Well, that is impressive. But after her, you really think other maids will talk to you? What if the employers find out?
The interviews would be conducted secretly, since, as you know, things are a little dangerous down here right now. The truth was, I had very little idea how dangerous things were. I had spent the past 4 years locked away in the padded room of college, reading Keats and Eudora Welty and worrying over term papers.
A little dangerous?
She laughed.
The marches in Birmingham? Martin Luther King? Dogs attacking colored children? Darling, it's the hottest topic in the nation.
But I'm sorry.
This will never work. Not as an article, because no Southern newspaper would publish it. And certainly not as a book. A book of interviews would never sell.
Oh, I heard myself say. I closed my eyes, feeling all the excitement drain out of me. I heard myself say again, oh.
I called because, frankly, it's a good idea, but there's no possible way to take it to print.
But what if... My eyes started darting around the pantry, looking for something to bring back her interest. Maybe I should talk about it as an article. Maybe a magazine. But she said no.
Eugenia? Who are you talking to in there?
Mother's voice cut through the crack. She inched the door open and I yanked it closed again. I covered the receiver, hissed.
I'm talking to Hilly, Mother. In the pantry? You're like a teenager again.
I mean,
Mrs. Stein let out a sharp tisk.
I suppose I could read what you get. God knows the book business could use some rattling.
You do that? Oh, Mrs. Stein.
I'm not saying I'm considering it, but do the interview and I'll let you know if it's worth pursuing.
I stuttered a few unintelligible sounds, finally coming out with, thank you, Mrs. Stein. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your help.
Don't thank me yet. Call Ruth, my secretary, if you need to get in touch.
And she hung up. I lug an old satchel to Bridge Club at Elizabeth's on Wednesday. It is red, it is ugly, and for today, at least, it is a prop. It's the only bag in Mother's house I could find large enough to carry the Miss Myrna letters. The leather is cracked and flaking. The thick shoulder strap leaves a brown mark on my blouse, where the leather stain is rubbing off. It was my grandmother Claire's gardening bag. She used to carry her garden tools around the yard in it, and the bottom is still lined with sunflower seeds. It matches absolutely nothing I own, and I don't care.
2 weeks, Hilly says to me, holding up two fingers. He's coming.
She smiles, and I smile back.
I'll be right back, I say, and I slip into the kitchen, carrying my satchel with me. Abilene is standing at the sink.
Afternoon,
she says quietly. It was a week ago that I visited her at her house. I stand there a minute, watching her stir the iced tea, feeling the discomfort in her posture, her dread that I might be about to ask for her help on the book again. I pull a few housekeeping letters out, and seeing this, Abilene's shoulders relax a little. As I read her a question about mold stains, she pours a little tea in a glass, tastes it. She spoons more sugar in the pitcher.
Oh, before I forget, I got the answer on that water ring question. Many say you just rub a little mayonnaise on it.
Abilene squeezes half a lemon in the tea.
Then go on and throw that no-good husband out the door.
She stirs, tastes.
Many don't take too well to husbands.
Thanks. I'll put that down, I say. As casually as I can, I pull an envelope from my bag. And here, I've been meaning to give you this. Abilene stiffens back into her cautious pose, the one she had when I walked in.
What you got there?
She says without reaching for it.
For your help, I say quietly. I've put away $5 for every article. It's up to $35 now.
Abilene's eyes move quickly back to her tea.
No thank you, ma'am.
Please take it. You've earned it.
I hear chairs scraping on wood in the dining room. Elizabeth's voice.
Please, Miss Skeeter. Miss Leaf won't have a fit if she find you giving me cash.
Abilene whispers.
She doesn't have to know.
Abilene looks up at me. The whites of her eyes are yellowed, tired. I know what she's thinking.
I already told you I'm sorry. I can't help you with that book, Miss Skeeter.
I set the envelope on the counter, knowing I've made a terrible mistake.
Please, find you another colored maid, a young'un, somebody else.
But I don't know any others well enough. I'm tempted to bring up the word friends, but I'm not that naive. I know we're not friends. Hilly's head pops through the door.
Come on, Skeeter, I'm fixing a deal.
And she disappears.
I'm begging you,
Abilene says.
Put that money away so Miss Lee folk don't see it.
I nod, embarrassed. I tuck the envelope in my bag, knowing we're worse off than ever. It's a bribe, she thinks, to get her to let me interview her. A bribe disguised as goodwill and thanks. I'd been waiting to give her the money anyway, once it added up to something. But it's true. My timing today had been deliberately planned. And now, I've scared her off for good.
Darling, just try it on your head. It cost $11. It must be good.
Mother has cornered me in the kitchen. I glance at the door to the hall, the door to the side porch. Mother comes closer, the thing in hand, and I'm distracted by how thin her wrists look, how frail her arms are carrying the heavy gray machine. She pushes me down into a chair, not so frail after all, and squeezes a noisy, farty tube of goo on my head. Mother's been chasing me with the magic soft and silky shine-a-later for 2 days now. She rubs the cream in my hair with both hands. I can practically feel the hope in her fingers. A cream will not straighten my nose or take a foot off my height. It won't add distinction to my almost translucent eyebrows, nor add weight to my bony frame. And my teeth are already perfectly straight. So this is all she has left to fix. My hair. Mother covers my dripping head with a plastic cap. She fastens a hose from the cap into a square machine. How long does this take, Mother? She picks up the booklet with a sticky finger.
It says here, cover with the miracle straightening cap, then turn on the machine and wait for the miraculous
10 minutes, 15. I hear a click, a rising rumble, then feel a slow, intense warmth on my head. But suddenly there's a pop. The tube is loose from the machine and jerking around like a mad fire hose. Mother shrieks, grabs at it, and misses. Finally, she snatches it and reattaches it. She takes a deep breath and picks up the booklet again. The miracle cap must remain on the head for 2 hours without removal or results. 2 hours? I'll have Pascagoula fix you a glass of tea, dear. Mother pats me on the shoulder and swishes out through the kitchen door. For 2 hours, I smoke cigarettes and read Life magazine. I finish To Kill a Mockingbird. Finally, I pick up the Jackson Journal, pick through it. It's Friday, so there won't be a Miss Myrna column. On page 4, I read, Boy blinded over segregated bathroom. Suspects questioned. It sounds familiar. I remember then. This must be Abilene's neighbor. Twice this week, I've gone by Elizabeth's house hoping she wouldn't be home so I could talk to Abilene, try to find some way to convince her to help me. Elizabeth was hunched over her sewing machine, intent on getting a new dress ready for the Christmas season, and it is yet another green gown, cheap and frail. She must have gotten a steal at the bargain bin on green material. I wish I could go down to Kennington's and charge her something new, but just the offer would embarrass her to death.
So, do you know what you're wearing for the date?
Hilly had asked the second time I came by.
Next Saturday?
I'd shrugged. I guess I have to go shopping. Just then, Abilene brought a tray of coffee out and set it on the table.
Thank you.
Elizabeth nodded to her.
Why, thank you, Abilene,
Hilly said, sugaring her cup.
I'll tell you, you make the best colored coffee in town.
Thank you, ma'am.
Abilene,
Hilly continued,
how do you like your new bathroom out there? It's nice to have a place of your own, now isn't it?
Abilene stared at the crack in the dining table.
Yes, ma'am.
You know, Mr. Holbrook arranged for that bathroom, Abilene. Sent the boys over, and the equipment, too.
Hilly smiled. Abilene just stood there, and I wished I wasn't in the room. Please, I thought. Please don't say thank you. Yes, ma'am. Abilene opened a drawer and reached inside, but Hilly kept looking at her. It was so obvious what she wanted. Another second passed with no one moving. Hilly cleared her throat, and finally, Abilene lowered her head.
Thank you, ma'am,
she whispered. She walked back into the kitchen. It's no wonder she doesn't want to talk to me. At noon, Mother removes the vibrating cap from my head, washes the goo from my hair while I lean back in the kitchen sink. She quickly rolls up a dozen curlers, puts me under her hair dryer hood in her bathroom. An hour later, I emerge pink and sore-headed and thirsty. Mother stands me in front of the mirror, pulling out curlers. She brushes out the giant circular mounds on my head. We stare, dumbfounded. Holy shit, I say. All I'm thinking is, the date. The blind date is next weekend. Mother smiles, shocked. She doesn't even scold me for cursing. My hair looks great. The shine-a-later actually worked. Chapter 9. On Saturday, the day of my date with Stuart Whitworth, I sit for 2 hours under the shine-a-later. Results, it seems, only last until the next wash. When I'm dry, I go to Kennington's and buy the flattest shoes I can find and a slim black crepe dress. I hate shopping, but I'm glad for the distraction to not have to worry about Mrs. Stein or Abilene for an afternoon. I charged the $85 to Mother's account, since she's always begging me to go buy new clothes.
Something flattering for your size.
I know Mother would profoundly disapprove of the cleavage the dress enables me to have. I've never owned a dress like this. In the Kennington's parking lot, I start the car, but cannot drive for the sudden pains in my stomach. I grip the white padded steering wheel, telling myself for the 10th time that it's ridiculous to wish for something I'll never have. To think I know the color blue his eyes are from a black and white photograph. To consider something a chance that is nothing but paper and filament and postponed dinners. But the dress, with my new hair, it actually looks pretty good on me. And I can't help but hope. It was 4 months ago when Hilly showed me the picture, out back by her swimming pool. Hilly was tanning in the sun. I was fanning in the murky shade. My heat rash had flared in July and hadn't subsided. "I'm busy," I said. Hilly sat on the edge of the pool, saggy and post-pregnant fat, inexplicably confident in her black swimsuit. Her stomach was paunchy, but her legs, as always, were thin and pretty.
"I haven't even told you when he's coming," she said. "And he comes from such a good family."
She was, of course, talking about her own. He was William's second cousin removed.
"Just meet him and see what you think."
I looked down at the picture again. He had clear, open eyes, light brown, curly hair, was the tallest in a group of men by a lake. But his body was half hidden by the others. He must not have all his limbs.
"There's nothing wrong with him," Hilly said. "Ask Elizabeth. She met him at the benefit last year while you were up at school. Not to mention, he dated Patricia Vandevender for forever."
Patricia Vandevender? Most beautiful at Ole Miss, 2 years in a row.
"Plus, he started his own oil business over in Vicksburg. So, if it doesn't work out, it's not like you'll be running into him every day in town."
"All right," I finally sighed. More than anything, to get Hilly off my back. It's past 3 o'clock by the time I get back home from buying the dress. I'm supposed to be at Hilly's at 6 to meet Stuart. I check the mirror. The curls are starting to fray on the ends, but the rest of my hair is still smooth. Mother was thrilled when I told her I wanted to try the Shinalator again and wasn't even suspicious of why. She doesn't know about my date tonight, and if she somehow finds out, the next 3 months will be full of excruciating questions like, "Did he call?" and "What did you do wrong?" when it doesn't work out. Mother's downstairs in the relaxing room with Daddy, hollering at the Rebel basketball team. My brother, Carlton, is on the sofa with his shiny new girlfriend. They drove up this afternoon from LSU. She has a dark, straight ponytail and wears a red blouse. When I get Carlton alone in the kitchen, he laughs, yanks my hair like we're kids again. "So how are you, sister?" I tell him about the job at the paper, that I'm editor of the league newsletter. I also tell him you better be moving back home after law school. "You deserve some of Mother's time, too. I'm taking more than my fair share here," I say through gritted teeth. He laughs like he understands, but how could he really? He's 3 years older than me, and great-looking, tall with wavy blonde hair, finishing LSU law school, protected by 170 miles of badly paved roads. When he goes back to his girlfriend, I search for Mother's car keys, but I can't find them anywhere. It's already 4:45. I go and stand in the doorway, try to catch Mother's attention. I have to wait for her to finish firing questions at Ponytail Girl about her people and where she's from. But Mother will not let up until she finds at least one person they have in common. After that, it's what sorority the girl was in at Vanderbilt. And she finally concludes by asking what her silver pattern is. "It's better than a horoscope," Mother always says. Ponytail Girl says her family pattern is Chantilly, but she'll be picking out her own new pattern when she gets married.
since I consider myself an independent thinker and all.
Carlton pets her on the head and she nudges against his hand like a cat. They both look up at me and smile.
Skeeter, Ponytail Girl says to me across the room, you're so lucky to come from a Francis the First family pattern. Will you keep it when you get married?
Francis the First is just dreamy, I beam. Why, I pull those forks out all the time just to look at them.
Mother narrows her eyes at me. I motion her to the kitchen, but another 10 minutes pass until she comes in.
Where in the world are your keys, Mama? I'm late for Hilly's. I'm staying there tonight.
What? But Carlton's home. What's his new friend going to think if you leave for something better to do?
I've put off telling her this because I knew, whether Carlton was home or not, it would turn into an argument.
And Pascagoula made a roast, and Daddy's got the wood all ready for a fire tonight in the relaxing room.
It's 85 degrees outside, Mama.
Now look, your brother is home, and I expect you to behave like a good sister. I don't want you leaving until you've had a nice long visit with this girl.
She's looking at her watch while I remind myself I'm 23 years old.
Please, darling,
she says, and I sigh and carry a damn tray of mint juleps out to the others.
Mama,
I say back in the kitchen at 5:28,
I have got to go. Where are your keys? Hilly's waiting on me. But we haven't even had the pigs in a blanket yet. Hilly's got a stomach bug,
I whisper,
and our help doesn't come in tomorrow. She needs me to watch the kids.
Mother sighs.
I guess that means you're going to church with them, too. And I thought we could all go tomorrow as a family, have Sunday dinner together. Mama, please,
I say, rummaging through a basket where she keeps her keys.
I can't find your keys anywhere. You can't take the Cadillac overnight. That's our good Sunday church car.
He's going to be at Hilly's in 30 minutes. I'm supposed to dress and do my makeup at Hilly's so Mother won't suspect anything.
I can't take Daddy's new truck. It's full of fertilizer, and I know he'll need it at dawn tomorrow. All right, I'll take the old truck, then. I believe it has a trailer on it. Go ask your daddy. But I can't ask Daddy, because I can't go through this in front of 3 other people who will look all hurt that I'm leaving. So I grab the old truck keys and say, it doesn't matter, I'm just going straight to Hilly's.
And I huff outside only to find that not only does the old truck have a trailer hitched to it, but a half-ton tractor on top of that trailer. So, I drive into town for my first date in 2 years, in a red 1941 Chevrolet 4 on the floor, with a John Deere motor grader hooked behind me. The engine sputters and churns, and I wonder if the truck will make it. Chunks of mud spray behind me off the tires. The engine stalls on the main road, sending my dress and bag flying onto the dirty floor. I have to restart twice. At 5:45, a black thing streaks out in front of me, and I feel a thunk. I try to stop, but braking is just not something you can do very quickly with a 10,000-pound piece of machinery behind you. I groan and pull over. I have to go check. Remarkably, the cat stands up, looks around, stunned, and shoots back into the woods as quickly as it came. At 6:03, after doing 20 in a 50, with horns honking and teenagers hollering at me, I park down the street from Hilly's house, since Hilly's cul-de-sac doesn't provide adequate parking for farm equipment. I grab my bag and run inside without even knocking. All out of breath and sweaty and wind-blown. And there they are, the 3 of them, including my date, having highballs in the front living room. I freeze in the entrance hall with all of them looking at me. William and Stuart both stand up. God, he's tall. Has at least 4 inches over me. Hilly's eyes are big when she grabs my arm.
Boys,
We'll be right back. Y'all just sit tight and talk about quarterbacks or something.
Hilly whisks me off to her dressing room and we both start groaning. It's just so goddamn awful.
Skeeter, you don't even have lipstick on. Your hair looks like a rat's nest.
I know. Look at me.
All traces of the Shinalator's miracle are gone.
There's no air conditioning in the truck. I had to ride with the damn windows down.
I scrub my face, and Hilly sits me in her dressing room chair. She starts combing my hair out the way my mother used to do, twisting it into these giant rollers, spraying it with Final Net.
Well, what did you think of him?
She asks. I sigh and close my unmascared eyes. He looks handsome. I smear the makeup on, something I hardly even know how to do. Hilly looks at me and smudges it off with a tissue, reapplies it. I slip into the black dress with the deep V in the front, the black Delman flats. Hilly quickly brushes out my hair. I wash out my armpits with a wet rag, and she rolls her eyes at me. I hit a cat, I say.
He's already had two drinks waiting on you.
I stand up and smooth my dress down. All right, I say. Give it to me. 1 to 10. Hilly looks me up and down, stops on the dip in the front of the dress. She raises her eyebrows. I've never shown cleavage before in my life. Kind of forgot I had it.
6, she says. Like she's surprised herself.
We just look at each other a second. Hilly lets out a little squeal, and I smile back. Hilly's never given me higher than a 4. When we come back into the front living room, William's pointing his finger at Stuart.
I'm gonna run for that seat, and by God, with your daddy's...
Stuart Whitworth, Hilly announces. I'd like to introduce Skeeter Phelan.
He stands up. And for a minute, my head is perfectly quiet inside. I make myself look like self-inflicted torture as he takes me in.
Stuart here went to school over at the University of Alabama, William says, adding, Roll Tide.
Nice to meet you. Stuart flips me a brief smile. Then he takes a long slurp of his drink until I hear the ice clink against his teeth.
So, where are we off to?
He asks William. We take William's Oldsmobile to the Robert E. Lee Hotel. Stuart opens my door and sits beside me in the back, but then leans over the seat talking to William about deer season the rest of the ride. At the table, he pulls out my chair for me and I sit, smile, say thank you.
You want a drink?
He asks me. Not looking my way. No thanks, just water, please. He turns to the waiter and says,
Double old Kentucky straight, with the water back.
I guess it's sometime after his 5th bourbon, I say. So, Hilly tells me you're in the oil business. That must be interesting.
The money's good, if that's what you really want to know.
Oh, I didn't, but I stop because he's craning his neck at something. I look up and see he's staring at a woman who's at the door, a busty blonde with red lipstick and a tight green dress. William turns to see what Stuart's looking at, but he swings back around quickly. He shakes his head no, very slightly, at Stuart, and I see, heading out the door, it's Hilly's old boyfriend, Johnny Foote, with his new wife, Celia. They leave and William and I glance at each other, sharing our relief that Hilly didn't see them.
Lord, that girl's hot as Tunica Blacktop,
Stuart says under his breath, and I suppose that's when I just stop caring what happens. At some point, Hilly looks at me to see what's going on. I smile like everything's fine and she smiles back, happy to see it's all working out.
William, the lieutenant governor just walked in. Let's go speak before he sits down.
They go off together, leaving us, the two lovebirds, sitting on the same side of the table, staring at all the happy couples in the room. "So," he says, hardly turning his head, "you ever go to any of the Alabama football games?" I never even made it to Colonel Field, and that was 5,000 yards from my bed. "No, I'm not really a football fan." I look at my watch. It's hardly 7:15. "That so?" He eyes the drink the waiter has handed him like he'd really enjoyed downing it. "Well, what do you do with your time?"
"I write a domestic maintenance column for the Jackson Journal."
He wrinkles his brow, then laughs.
"Domestic maintenance? You mean housekeeping?"
I nod.
"Jesus!"
He stirs his drink.
"I can't think of anything worse than reading a column on how to clean house,"
he says, and I notice that his front tooth is the slightest bit crooked. I long to point this imperfection out to him, but he finishes his thought with,
"Except maybe writing it."
I just stare at him.
"Sounds like a ploy to me, to find a husband, becoming an expert on keeping house."
"Well, you must be a genius. You figured out my whole scheme."
"Isn't that what you women from Old Miss major in? Professional husband hunting?"
I watch him, dumbfounded. I may not have had a date in umpteen years, but who does he think he is? "I'm sorry, but were you dropped on your head as an infant?" He blinks at me, then laughs for the first time all night. "Not that it's any of your business," I say, "but I had to start somewhere if I plan on being a journalist." I think I've actually impressed him, but then he throws back the drink and the look is gone. We eat dinner, and from his profile I can see his nose is a little pointy, his eyebrows are too thick, and his light brown hair too coarse. We say little else, to each other at least. Hilly chats, throwing things our way like, "Stuart, Skeeter here lives on a plantation just north of town. Didn't the senator grow up on a peanut farm?" Stuart orders yet another drink. When Hilly and I go to the bathroom, she gives me a hopeful smile. "What do you think?" "He's tall," I say, surprised she hasn't noticed that not only is my date inexplicably rude, but drop-dead drunk. The end of the meal finally comes, and he and William split the check. Stuart stands up and helps me with my jacket. At least he has nice manners.
"Jesus, I've never met a woman with such long arms," he says.
"Well, I've never met anybody with such a drinking problem."
"Your coat smells like..."
He leans down and sniffs it, grimacing.
"Fertilizer."
He strides off to the men's room, and I wish I could disappear. The car ride, all 3 minutes of it, is impossibly silent and long. We go back inside Hilly's house. Yule May comes out in her white uniform, says, "They all fine, went to bed good," and she slips out through the kitchen door. I excuse myself to the bathroom.
"Skeeter, why don't you drive Stuart home?"
William says when I come out.
"I'm bushed, aren't you, Hilly?"
Hilly is looking at me like she's trying to figure out what I want to do. I thought I'd made it obvious when I stayed in the bathroom for 10 minutes.
"Your car's not here?"
I ask the air in front of Stuart.
"I don't believe my cousin's in a position to drive,"
William laughs. Everyone's quiet again.
"I came in a truck," I say. "I'd hate for you to..."
"Shoot," William says, slapping Stuart on the back.
"Stuart doesn't mind riding in a truck, do you, buddy?"
"William," Hilly says, "why don't you drive, and Skeeter, you can ride alone."
"Not me, I'm too boozed up myself,"
William says, even though he just drove us home.
Finally, I just walk out the door. Stuart follows me, doesn't comment that I didn't park in front of Hilly's house or in Hilly's driveway. When we get to my truck, we both stop, stare at the 15-foot tractor hooked behind my vehicle.
You pulled that thing all by yourself?
I sigh. I guess it's because I'm a big person and have never felt petite or particularly feminine or girly. But that tractor, it just seems to sum up so much.
That is the funniest damn-looking thing I have ever seen, he says.
I step away from him. Hilly can take you, I say. Hilly will drive you. He turns and focuses on me for what I'm pretty sure is the first time all night. After several long moments of standing there being looked at, my eyes fill with tears. I'm just so tired. Oh, shit, he says, and his body loosens. Look, I told Hilly I wasn't ready for any damn date. Don't, I say, backing away from him, and I head back to the house. Sunday morning I get up early, before Hilly and William, before the kids and the church traffic. I drive home with the tractor rumbling behind me. The fertilizer smell gives me a hangover, even though I had nothing but water last night. I'd gone back in Hilly's house last night, Stuart trailing behind me. Knocking on Hilly's bedroom door, I asked William, who already had a mouthful of toothpaste, would he mind driving Stuart home? I'd walked upstairs to the guest room before he even answered. I step over Daddy's dogs on the porch, go into my parents' house. As soon as I see Mother, I give her a hug. When she tries to let go, I can't let her.
What is it, Skeeter? You didn't catch Hilly's stomach bug, did you?
No, I'm fine. I wish I could tell her about my night. I feel guilty for not being nicer to her, for not needing her until my own life turns bad. I feel bad for wishing Constantine was here instead. Mother pats my windblown hair down since it must be adding at least 2 inches to my height.
You sure you're not feeling bad?
I'm all right, Mama. I'm too tired to resist. I ache like someone kicked me in the stomach. With boots on. It won't go away.
You know, she says, smiling, I think this might be the one for Carlton.
Good, Mama, I say. I'm really glad for him. At 11 o'clock the next morning, the phone rings. Luckily, I'm in the kitchen and pick it up.
Miss Skeeter?
I stand very still, then look out at Mother examining her checkbook at the dining room table. Pascagoula is pulling a roast out of the oven. I go into the pantry and shut the door.
Abilene?
I whisper. She's quiet a second and then she blurts it out.
What if you don't like what I got to say? I mean about white peoples.
This isn't about my opinion, I say. It doesn't matter how I feel.
But how I know you ain't gonna get mad, turn around on me.
I guess you'll just have to trust me. I hold my breath, hoping, waiting. There's a long pause.
Lord have mercy.
I reckon I'm gonna do it.
Abilene!
My heart is pounding.
You have no idea how much I appreciate...
Miss Skeeter, we gonna have to be real careful.
We will, I promise.
And you gonna have to change my name. Mine, Miss Lee Foltz, everybody's.
Of course. I should have mentioned this. When can we meet? Where can we meet?
Can't do it in the white neighborhood, that's for sure. I guess we gonna have to do it over at my house.
Do you know any other maids who might be interested? I ask, even though Mrs. Stein has only agreed to read.